The sound check. Yes.
No pressure to be interesting during the sound check.
Right.
But once we're rolling for real, then there's
a lot of pressure.
You sent me some information. Anything else? Anything you want to plug or promote? Or you got?
Yeah. So I just started a new meetup called the 5 Minute Story.
Okay.
And it's starting in Burbank. It'll be the first Saturday morning, once a month, at the Actor or LA Connection Theater in Burbank.
So is it really 5 minute stories?
So we're going to focus on getting your story as tight as possible.
Oh, right.
Because some of the storytelling events I went to, it was a 5 minute story drawn out in 15 minutes. It's like, come on, man. Rehearsal's a good thing. You should. So I kind of wanted to build a tribe of people that are also into that. Like, okay, I'm going to tell this story, but it's going to be as quick and punchy. It could be for a pitch. It could be for a wedding. It could be for stand-up. It could be for storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, I know The Moth is like five minutes or 5 to 7. They'll cut you out. So it's, you know, you got to go up prepared.
Yeah.
So it's it's kind of a workshop and and rehearsal.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
I realized I offered you water and then I didn't give it to you. But I'm going to tell you, this is the most important part of the show right here. This is the Comedy Death Star coffee mug.
Nice. I like it.
A lot of times I say I haven't sold any of these. I try to sell them online just because, you know, what the heck, why not?
Right.
But somebody recently bought 5 of them.
Nice.
One of the guests. He thought that he would be on the show and then people would want a coffee mug, his friends. Maybe he's given them as a Christmas gift. I'm not sure. But stylish, right?
Yeah.
I know you're only saying that because you're on the show.
Yeah.
And you can't be like, no, your mug sucks to the host right before we
start. Well, what was the inspiration for using the Death Star? Just because it's kind of the evil side of,
well,
of the environment?
The dark side of comedy, yes. But also, my goal with this particular thing is to get popular enough that I get a cease and desist letter from Lucasfilm and Disney, which I will then use
frame.
To propel my fame, right? Then you have like a big guy, little guy.
Sure,
I think I can get a lot of press if they sue me. So
nice.
That's my goal.
Right.
To get sued by
those
guys.
You don't have to answer this question, but you're not. Are you making money off this podcast? Because that's when they start. Okay, well, they don't care. It's all
really?
Fan. Yeah,
I got to make more money. Well, if I
at least Lucas was fine with all the fan stuff as long as you weren't trying to make a buck on his stuff.
So I have to make a little bit more money.
You have to make money. It has to become lucrative for you. Then they'll try and squash
then
your dreams.
Try to, okay. All right, so we have some goals. So this is now we're working on my 2018 New Year's resolution.
Right.
Make enough money to get the attention.
You have to start making money on that name. And then Disney will come down on you and say no.
All right. Okay. All right, well, that's good. I'm glad we're covering this. One more thing. This bell right here.
Yes.
It's for you.
Okay.
Anytime you want to ring it because you're happy, sad, angry, confused, if you don't like the questions I'm asking and you want to switch the subject, any reason at all, if you have to pee and you don't want to raise your hand, you can ring the bell. And it's there just because, you know.
Sure.
You never get to ring the bell.
Nice.
Do you ever go up to the counter at a place where there is one of these bells and the guy doing the coffee is standing right there? And you say, hey, can I ring your bell? And they go like, oh. You can see their heart sinks because they hate the bell.
I've had it where there was no one at the desk.
Yeah.
And I went to go ring it. And someone saw me and popped out to make sure that I did not ring that bell.
Yeah. Because you can anytime.
Appreciate it.
Shall we start the show?
We shall.
You sure?
Right. Yeah.
You feeling nervous?
No. Yesterday I felt funky and I'm still kind of coming out of that. I don't know. Some sickness was trying to get in on me.
All
so
right.
I'm a little, my eyes are a little goofy. But other than that.
Okay. Well, I just thought you were kind of high. Are you a Waker and Baker?
No, I am a straight edge guy, which is
straight edge. I know how old you are now. You say straight edge. That kids right. Say that.
I didn't really know what it was in high school until some people hung on where, but it had to do a lot with suspected racist skinheads, right? So the straight edge were the racist punk skinhead. No, it just was a rumor mill.
Yeah, I see.
Because then I later saw, who's the guy that started that? It was like Minor Threat.
Minor Threat.
I think it was the lead.
Ian McKay, Minor Threat, yeah.
And then he kept saying, I don't know why people think we're racist. it's about the music and
skinhead thing, I think.
Yeah.
Minor Threat, those guys, DC. Yeah, I was also in high school, I was a totally straight-edged person because I would go to a party and it was just dumb. It was stupid. I didn't like how beer affected me, but then if you go to a high school event when everyone's loaded and you're not, it's really dumb.
Hence not many high school events for me.
No.
Yeah, I took care of my friends when they were drunk.
Yeah.
Out of high school and into early college, and then it was dumb, and I didn't enjoy it anymore. So then I just kind of kept moving away from my friends because I didn't like that. Yeah. You know, when you're sober and you are around drunk or high people, they're not fun. You have to be drunk or high to be around drunk and high people and have fun.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're just friggin' annoying.
Yeah. No. And when you're drunk or high, you think that everything you say is more interesting and more clever. And no, it's the opposite.
Right.
All right. Hello, everybody. I decided this morning I wanted to do this whole show doing my Richard Nixon impersonation, so I'm just going to do the introduction as
and all the questions.
I'm not sure. Just I said you. Well, here I'll let you know.
Okay.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. It's starting to sound like Jimmy Stewart. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. My guest this week is filmmaker, storyteller, and traveler, world traveler. I just put that in, but that's true, right?
Not world.
Okay. Well,
just the United States.
I just said traveler. So, Glenn Dunsweiler.
Yes.
I also decided that any time that I said your name, Glenn Dunsweiler, it sounds like it should be with that kind of Glenn Dunsweiler voice. And then I'm going to put an echo effect in it. So, anytime you say Glenn Dunsweiler, it's going to.
Yeah. It's German, though. So, if you get too exuberant about that, people get the wrong impression.
Okay. All right. I'll take it easy. Glenn has a documentary out now called Why Homeless?
Yeah.
Right? Which I hear is chock full of laughs.
It is chock full of laughs.
It's out on Amazon.
Yeah.
We will chat about that and more in a moment, but first a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. My guest today is Glenn Dunsweiler. Left some space for the echo.
Apparently, in history, it was von Dunsweiler before in the old country.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to write a joke this morning where I said, is this a Hawaiian name? Because I looked it up in Hawaiian, and it's like something, Iki Tiki Pugawakai, which translates, but I didn't finish that joke. So,
nice.
Anyway. Hi, welcome. Thanks for coming on the
show.
Thanks
for having me.
Because you don't really know me.
No, I met you once.
Yeah, you met me once. And then I said, hey, come to the show. And you came here.
Yeah.
On a Friday morning.
Yeah.
You okay? You feel safe? You don't feel like this is a weird situation? You don't know me?
I'm bigger than you are, so really, I feel safe.
Yeah, that's good. All right, that's good. I would just say, where are you from? I didn't
Sacramento, originally.
Sacramento. Okay. Yeah. And I wanted to ask a silly question. You know, the story when I met you, you were talking about your grandmother.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more. I just got some snippets about her, but she sounds like a super interesting person.
She's
going to ask a question about your grandmother. That's where I start.
Yeah, absolutely. My grandmother was an artist, a painter from southern Wisconsin.
Okay.
So farm stock. Really kind of salt of the earth, hate that phrase, but
isn't salt bad for the earth? Yeah. Like, isn't bad that you, you put it on the crops, your things die, right?
Yeah.
So why do we say salt of the earth when that's a toxic thing for?
I have to look that up.
Yeah, we're going to check it out. All right.
But really, really.
We're going to do some research. See how that bell works?
I see. Yeah.
All right.
So she was stoic, kind of a stoic, wry sense of humor person. And just that whole family was stable and strong, didn't take any BS, and was kind, but would remind you that you were whining or remind you to suck it up and live life, because they're farmers, and they went through the Depression, so they were part of the greatest generation, right? That was they were called. And
now I was not sure, because is Tom Brokaw wrote that book, The Greatest Generation? Did he write it about, you remember that book, or maybe like Dan Rather or someone?
Who
named them The Greatest Generation? Was it us or was it them?
So I think that writer named them that, and
it stuck.
Why were they the greatest generation? Because they were the tipping point of when their generation started to make it better for the following generation, I believe.
Well, they were kind of the only generation who's done that now, though. And also World War One.
Yeah.
And I think World War One was kind of the tipping point when America started to assert itself as a dominant world power.
Right.
I think that was kind of the turn of the century, and World War One made that happen.
So, my grandmother was a kind of no BS kind of lady, but kind as well, and would just, as you grow up and have puberty problems and emotional problems, she kind of would be kind, but she would not take any of your guff. I remember one day I was helping her pit cherries. And so I have a bowl and I'm pitting these cherries and the cherries are staining my fingertips red. And I realized that the red's not coming off. And I'm wondering about my sexuality and wondering about roles. And I'm thinking, no, now I have painted red nails. Is this going to come off? And my grandmother, I'm kind of visibly freaking out as a...
And how old are you?
8-year-old, a 9-year-old. You know, oh my God, the girls are going to make fun of me or whatever. And I said, does this come off? And she said, in about a week. Just didn't care that I was really freaked out about this. But that's the kind of woman she was. And my parents, they just kind of prod you and push you to make you comfortable in your own skin. And if you're not comfortable in your own skin, they kind of jab you a little bit more.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds a little painful.
Yeah.
Can be.
But
you think it makes you a better person.
Yeah. They weren't abusive. Uh-huh. They weren't, you know, hitting me with chains. They weren't locking me in a closet. They weren't. Yeah. They were jabbing me to make me a better person, because they grew up with possibly not the ability to eat the next day. Right. So everything in the weight of scales was making me realize that I didn't have any problems.
Now, the interesting thing, as you're telling the story, I'm just noticing that you're kind of blushing a little. And, do you notice that? That when you tell these stories about your family and how they kind of prodded and pushed you along in a loving way, that you're still feeling a little uncomfortable about something. Am I getting that right, or am I just making stuff up?
No, I think you're just making stuff up. Okay. I'm pretty comfortable. Okay. When I was going along with that ideal, when I was, I think, in junior college, was when Howard Stern first broke on the national spotlight.
Yeah. You know,
he wasn't just this New York DJ guy. Yes. He was being interviewed by Barbara Walters for 2020. And he said, if something makes me uncomfortable about myself, I put it out there. I don't want that to hinder me in any way. And so I let other people know that that bothers me, and then I make fun of it and they make fun of it. And then it has no power anymore.
Right.
And that was just this really amazing light bulb moment where I thought, I'm going to be like that. And for the record, I'm not a huge fan of Howard Stern. I don't listen to Howard Stern.
Sure.
But in a way, Howard Stern changed my life.
So far I have that your heroes and inspirations for your life are your grandmother and Howard Stern. I like this. I like this show. This is awesome. And I noticed also, along the way, you said that side of your family is this, and you know, the very farmery. Is the other side of your family a total mess?
My other side is also mostly German,
okay.
But darker German.
Okay.
My grandmother on my father's side was Yugoslavian.
Okay.
Specifically Croatian, which I did not know.
So is that darker, like skin?
Darker skin.
I wasn't sure if you meant like philosophically.
Well, and they're poorer. They're poorer people, right? So my mother's parents were farmers and business people. And ultimately, out of World War II, in World War II, out of World War II, upper middle class.
Yes.
Middle, upper middle.
Yeah.
And my dad's family was barely middle class.
Okay.
I mean, poverty was right there. My dad talks about eating spaghetti sandwiches and it's just carbohydrates on carbohydrates, whatever you have in the house. Because they had five kids and less money. And my mom's family, there were three kids and more money. So
just that's the math. That's the math.
Yeah.
Now, here's a non sequitur kinds of question, but I wanted to ask it because we're here and it's early December. Do you have like a holiday downer story, Christmas downer story? I want to put together a show in the next couple of weeks that's all like holiday downers.
Every holiday is a downer for me. No, because I work in entertainment and have worked in entertainment. And a lot of live entertainment, there are always shows going on during holidays.
Yeah.
So for me, holidays always just meant work.
Oh, that's good.
And for my family, that meant that they weren't going to see me. And that did not sit well. And also for my friends, it was, can't you just get 1/4 of July off, man? You know, no, I can't. I'm working.
Right.
Can't. So
everybody else has a downer story. The Christmas that Glenn didn't show up.
Right.
That's.
The one the downer holiday was a downer Christmas or downer holiday.
Downer holiday.
My grandmother died right before Thanksgiving. Right.
Oh.
So that was that story that I. Got to go to her funeral in southern Wisconsin and tell a story about how she poked and prodded me.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's a pretty downer story, right?
Downer story, Thanksgiving, grandma dying. All right, good. Well, they're out there. I just want to collect them in the all right, let's switch things up.
Okay.
Get into your stuff. I was looking at your website.
Sure.
And your productions and company and
sure.
things you're producing. And you said something there about that all the stories that you like to tell are about this other voice and kind of an outsider voice.
Right.
And I'm curious, like, what speaks to you about that? Or, you know, why is that what you want to represent?
It started when I got into understanding what homelessness was in this country and understanding that people were speaking for homeless people that weren't homeless themselves. And they were therefore missing the point or missing some logic that becomes very apparent when people that don't normally have a voice get to speak for themselves. You know, things like when I screened Why Homeless for my family, my uncle came up to me and he said, why don't homeless guys just mow lawns? And I said, well, let's think through the logistics of that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're homeless. Maybe you have a car, maybe you don't, but I don't think you necessarily have a truck. do you just walk around with this lawnmower? And then how do you fill it with gasoline? Do you have a gas can that you also walk around with? And then when you are not mowing lawns, where do you put said lawnmower? And I said, also, are you going to accept some random guy showing up at your doorstep, older man probably, saying, hey, can I mow your lawn? And are you going to fire your current gardener to give this guy work? And he started putting all that logic together and went, oh, I guess my theory about them just mowing lawns kind of has some holes in it. So if I let the other person speak, those they navigate us through those logical conclusions.
So it started with this this documentary. When did you finish this, Why Homeless?
2011.
2011, okay. And it's being distributed. It's up on Amazon. And, why did you start to take this journey? Because you went on a four-month thing about making this film, right?
Yeah. So I bought a house in 2006.
Okay.
That was a bad year to buy a house.
In retrospect. Yeah.
In 2008, I was going to get cut back at work. We're going to work furloughs. So I knew when the furloughs were going to happen, in about 4 months' time. I called my bank and I said, hey, in about 4 months, I'm not going to be able to make these mortgage payments. Can we talk? Can we negotiate? And they told me, we won't talk to you until you stop paying. And I thought, well, so then I started doing my logical follow through. Well, if I stop paying, then I ruin my credit. And then if the bank decides to foreclose on me, I now don't have a house and I have bad credit to not be able to get into an apartment. So now I'm a guy with a graduate degree that's teaching at a university that has a full-time job that's homeless. What's going on here? And so that made me start to do research on who homeless people were and how they got there. And then with my production background, I just decided – I'm going to make a documentary about this so other people can see what the heck is happening and who these homeless people are.
Who they really are.
Yeah.
And so what did you find out? I didn't watch the whole movie. I watched a little bit. But you met a bunch of people, homeless people that work in the field, right?
Yeah. Over 100 people probably I met. This country has a lot of messed up families.
Yeah.
More messed up families than I realized. And – because my family, they poke and prod, but they're not messed up, right? And so I just thought everyone had a family like that. And in this country, we have personal networks, either our family or our church, whatever it may be. So when we fall down, when we get sick, when we lose our job, when we have work furloughs, when we whatever it may be, our family is the one to pick up the slack. Yeah. And if we don't have a personal network, the public network has so many holes in it, odds are you're going to end up homeless, or the threat of homelessness is going to be there for you, because housing is the most expensive component of your life and the hardest to cover.
So you must have met a lot of people who were surprised that they had become homeless, found themselves homeless in a surprising way, and still have jobs and stuff, right?
Right. And then the thing is, we in this country think homeless people are mentally ill or drug addicts, right?
Lazy.
Those are the two, or lazy, right?
Yeah.
So there's this character judgment that goes with it. So then when you become homeless, you start to judge your own character. And depression comes in very quickly, and then depression just messes with you from front to back. You know, it's that psychological stopgap where I can't do anything because I get into this world of just thinking about how I messed up or I am an awful person for this. And then if you have children, then the extra guilt of not being able to provide for your children just starts mounting on you, and then that becomes this monolithic weight that a lot of people have trouble breaking through. With time, people can, but then as you're running the homeless clock, you're falling farther and farther and farther as the time that's needed to get through depression is happening. And so by the time you come out of depression, you're now in a physically worse state than you were when you started. So then why wouldn't you just stay depressed?
So now, did you lose your home at the end of this time, or you did not?
So
you did not.
I did not.
That's all right.
Well, because there are some people that are just more resourceful. So I would talk to people and they'd say, well, I would never become homeless. And that may be true. There are people that have other gifts that others don't.
Sure.
That will refuse to be depressed. Right. Will refuse. Will figure it out. I've met plenty of people that will just say, I would never be homeless. My ex-wife would say, I would never be homeless. I would.
But nobody plans it. And when it happens to you, it's
right.
A surprise. I mean, that's part of the package.
Right. Yeah. So what I ended up doing, I needed to talk to my bank. So I stopped paying them. And then I wanted to tell everyone what else was what was going on in my life. So I used the money that I would have paid on my house to then fund this documentary.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
There you right. Go. And then I just was relentless in talking to the bank and calling the bank and getting the right paperwork and getting some movement, or making sure that they knew that they were dropping the ball and I wasn't dropping the ball. And it was just, it was hard because I still had a mostly full-time job and I had a house to take care of and I had a family, a wife. And then I had this other full-time job of calling the banks, and not a lot of people would do that. And I'm tenacious.
Well, you had some resources, right? Whatever, your education, your background, I mean.
Yeah, and my grandmother poking at me, it doesn't suck. No one's chasing you with a machete. Calm down, keep going.
Yeah.
You know, and so I just pushed through. And it was about, I think, 3 years of just me dogging the banks and saying, what are we doing? What's going on? And we ended up modifying the loan. And then once we got modified, it just became apparent. We bought the house at $395,000. And by 2011, it was worth $185,000. And
that's heartbreaking.
We were still on the hook for $395,000. They didn't modify it. They didn't lessen it. They just extended the loan.
Yeah.
And so it didn't become an investment anymore. It became a detriment.
Yeah.
And so we short sold the house.
Yeah.
Well,
that happened a lot in that time
period.
Yeah. Now, in our introduction, I said, this movie, Why Homeless? I heard there's lots of laughs in it. There is humor in the stories,
absolutely.
And the people in the life. I mean, what do you find about what can we laugh at in people being homeless?
Sure. One of the most charming stories. I met a couple that found themselves homeless again. It was how is this doing? Both of them ended up losing their jobs, and they were talking about how they were living in Sacramento, down by the river. And they'd been there maybe 3 weeks. They hadn't had a shower in probably 9-10 days. And they were talking kind of the logistics of what you have to do to go get food and then go look for a job and wait in line for a shower. And they said they saw these vultures come down, and the guys yelled at the vultures, "We're not dead yet. We just smell like it." And I just thought that's beautiful. That's humor. That's, you're not losing your humanity.
Right.
That guy refused to lose his humor and his humanity, even though he smelled like hell. He was with his wife. He was sad that he couldn't provide for her. they were struggling. They had all their stuff that was in a shopping cart, and every day they had to move it to the shopping cart. And, you know, he would talk about the logistics of how to move your life that's all in a shopping cart. Oh, the other thing is they when they got the last night they were out of their apartment, they didn't know how to be homeless. So they were trying to take as much of this stuff in their house as possible. Oh, I need this pillow. Oh, I need this stuffed animal. Oh, I need this soap and this soap. And then so they got out there and they can't move it all. And then they realize, well, what are we going to do with this anyway? We're down by the river.
Right.
You know, I don't need the, you know, pressure washer.
Right. They took things that were valuable that they didn't want to leave. But then, yeah. And see, now that part, I never thought about that. I've thought about what it would be like to live out there, and you see people living out on the street and you say, wow, that's going to be hard. But I hadn't really thought about this process of losing or leaving your home.
Yeah.
And learning how to be homeless has got to be
a
weird, like whatever,
it's a
week
skill.
Or month. Or, yeah, it is a skill. I mean, yeah, you get skills.
When I first started interfacing with homeless people, I actually found a network on the internet that was tips and tricks for how to be homeless, because people were going homeless and they had no idea what to do. So it was kind of a support group online. And one of the guys said, one or two things you need to keep no matter what. You have to keep your phone, because you will lose contact with the outside world if you don't keep your phone. And then keep your car, because that's your one safety. If you can keep your safety, that's some moderate safety of you being able to move, you being able to stay in there and not get victimized. But if you have to get rid of the car, whatever you do, keep your phone.
Yeah.
You have to keep your phone. And then I saw that post, and then when I was doing research and interviewing people, there was a critical story about a homeless man that had a camera phone, and the whole criticism of, well, if you're homeless, how can you afford a camera phone? And people just want to dive into that criticism of finances instead of actually the realistic situation that a camera phone costs $300 over time and a place to live costs $750 minimum a month. So,
well, and like you said, I mean, you're homeless, but your life is not over, and you want to stay connected to the world and people and look for a job. And yeah, you need to do that. Let me ask you about some other stuff you've been working on. I saw on the bottom of the thing you said you have a play called The Bad Play.
Yeah, The Bad Play.
Yeah, tell me anything about that. That sounds good.
The Bad Play sounds good. So yeah, I call it The Bad Play. I love the juxtaposition of what would these people do in this situation. And The Bad Play is something I wrote where a man has lost his wife, and his daughter is severely impaired. She's got multiple problems, but he loves his daughter.
How old is the daughter?
13 or so. But he's kind of spinning down in this reality of having to take care of her as a single father. And he's also – he hurt his back, so he's out of work. So he's on welfare right now, and he's just trying to keep it together. And this paramedic who gets called to help one day kind of gets attached to – this man and this family, and she wants to help, but then she realizes that the only way to help is to possibly get rid of this daughter. And so you have this paramedic in this conundrum where she wants to help, but she sees the father just going down, and in her viewpoint, she can't see how he could succeed with her. Yet the father obviously never would want to get rid of his daughter. So you just have this difficult situation where you have this person that's supposed to help this paramedic, and then her only solution looking out is the daughter's got to go.
Or it's unacceptable. Yeah. And he has other children aside from
his daughter? No, it's just that one. Just one. Okay. And so, yeah.
All right. Well, that also sounds full of laughs.
It is. And in that, well, so in it, whenever I write stuff, whenever I focus on stories, I focus on the humanity of people. And there is funny stuff in the humanity. So in that play, the interplay of the father and the daughter, the interplay of the paramedic and the father, the interplay of the paramedic and the daughter, they're not – no one in my world is bad. There's no bad person. There are people with conflicts.
And people who struggle.
And there's humor in that. There's humor in depression as long as you focus on the humanity of that. There's humor in everything. There's humor in killing, you know? General Butt Naked in – you ever hear about him in
– No.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. This other thing you're working on, Deuce.
Yeah.
That actually does sound funny. These other stories sound not – funny stories, but I'm, you know, quoting. But this sounds like there's a humor element in it, right? You say Deuce is a kind of Forrest Gump, urban Forrest Gump
character. Yeah, yeah. Think of it as the Big Lebowski for black people.
Okay. Yeah.
In that kind of offbeat adventure about an offbeat person. Deuce is a hustler from the South Side of Chicago, based on one of my ex-students' real lives and him. And he, again, refuses to go into anger because anger does no good. He's an intelligent person, but he also has no idea how to get what he wants, and he has no idea what he wants. And he really connects with people, and people connect with him, and that's his power. That's one of his hustling powers, is the way he can just kind of meld into anybody. But because of that, he gets in some really bizarre situations, and he kind of thinks of things in a different way, and it follows through in this travel of Forrest Gumptitude, where you're like, well, how'd you? Okay, who else would do that? Okay, you know, and.
Well, now I'm going to say, like Bill Cosby used to say, but you can't say that anymore, right? His television show, if you're not careful, you might just learn something.
Right.
But now that sounds creepy. Even that phrase, if you're not careful, you might just learn something. Because when you were around Bill Cosby, you had to be careful. Now we realize if you're a woman.
Which, you learn something.
But it sounded like a nice statement when it was on the cartoon, but now it sounds creepy.
Right. I think we have a problem detaching the work from the person. Right. And that's always going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But the stuff that Bill Cosby did in entertainment and the words of wisdom he had are still words of wisdom.
Yeah.
They just are tainted because of our impression of that person.
Sure.
It's like Hitler's paintings, right? I remember watching there was some gallery that wanted to do an art show of Hitler's paintings, and everybody was up in arms. You can't show Hitler's paintings. And then they started talking about the quality of his painting, you know, and he did all these landscapes. They were competent. They're not amazing, but they're not awful. Right. They're competent. So – but because he was Hitler, like, these are awful. They're not really awful. You could put him up as an art show. The art doesn't have anything to do with the guy and his genocide, you know? I mean,
or maybe you show the paintings and then you say, you know, let's look at Hitler through the eyes of the painting. Like, this was also part of him. And can we understand something else about him through his work than just the thing we know?
Right. And I think he wanted to be an artist, and then the other artist said, no, you're not good enough. He went, all right, I'm going to go with my other strengths.
Fine. I'll do something else. See? This is why we should have more money for the arts, so we can save a lot of things. All right. I got some other questions here.
Sure.
How old were you when you first ran away from home?
Ran away from home?
Yeah. Did you ever run away from home when you were a kid or a grown up?
No.
No.
No, okay. I never.
Next question. Is there some part of you that you think most people don't understand, or they get wrong, or they miss?
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Well, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't gamble. So as far as other people are concerned, I'm a narc. my job
or
is...
Or a Christian. Yeah,
my job is to judge them in their selected vice.
Well, right? It's good we've never had a narc on the show. As far as I know, right. Maybe I have and just nobody admits it. Yeah.
Right. So people treat me like I am in judgment of their lives, and I just want to be cool, man. I want to live my life and be cool. And being cool to me is not drinking, not smoking, not doing any of that. I don't do it. I don't need it. It doesn't speak to me.
And have you considered a man bun?
I had a man bun in the 90s, in 92. people said I looked like Steven Seagal because I had it shaved on the sides and back, and I had it really long on top, and then I pull it back in a ponytail. So it was a really high ponytail.
Oh, so it was kind of like a Japanese mullet.
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah. So I've done that. That's in the past.
But that was in the – okay, so yeah.
It wasn't called a man bun.
Yeah. And I had also in 90 – yeah, same time, 90 – late 80s, 90, 91 – I had a little ponytail. It was, you know, short.
Right.
I didn't put it on the top, though. That mm-hmm. whole thing hadn't
right.
started yet.
I did, though. So I was a drum major in high school, and all that hair had to go underneath the shako.
Okay.
And
is that the hat?
It's okay. The hat. It's called a shako. Yeah. Yeah. And
I never heard that word before.
Okay. I used to have the color guard French braid my hair. And I look like a Klingon because it just looked like a spine that was right over the top of my head. Yeah.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
All right. Now I want hair again. All right. Here's another question. When you were a child, you had an imaginary friend.
Yeah. Sort of. I would always do good deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Bob. B-A-W-B. I would joke.
B-A-W-B.
B-A-W-B, Bob.
And I would always. Wisconsin accent, Bob.
I don't know. I think it was just humor. I thought, okay. I'm going to name him Bob and write it strangely. B-A-W-B. So I would do nice things for my parents and then leave notes and say, Bob was here. And yeah, that was my imaginary friend.
He was your imaginary friend. When was this? How old were you? How long?
I came up with it when I was 9 or 10, okay. And then I kept it going until I was moved out of the house at 24.
Really? All right, Bob. And Bob also had an imaginary friend. I just like the idea that an imaginary friend could have his own imaginary friend. Where is Bob and his imaginary friend? Where did he go after you left home? I mean, do they disappear, these imaginary friends, or do they get re-released? Like, matter can't be destroyed. I'm not sure about imaginary friends.
I don't call it Bob anymore, but my I feel that you have to do good for people, and you should make it hurt. So you, if it
make
puts,
it hurt?
It, make it
you.
Hurt. Yeah. So
okay,
if it puts, if no, not them. Okay. So if it puts you out, then you should do it. And so
that's
Bob,
why you're here on the
Bob
show.
Lives with me, you know. I just say no. This is fun. I appreciate it. So Bob is with me always. I just don't call him Bob because then I'm a 40, almost 44 year old man. It gets kind of weird if you have imaginary friends. Yes.
All right, now I have a question here that is a question I ask every one of my guests, and it's I get a sponsor. I get a different sponsor every week. So this week, this question is sponsored by the Museum of Jurassic Technology.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you've ever been there.
I had a friend that just went, and she was telling me about it.
It's awesome, right?
It was awesome.
Yeah, it's at 9341 Venice Boulevard in Culver City, and I'm not going to give you any spoilers. Because for a while before I went, I just said the Museum of Jurassic Technology. What the hell could that possibly mean?
Right.
no spoilers, but you will be surprised and delighted by what you find there, right? Your friend had a great time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. So this week's question, special question, is sponsored by the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Culver City. So here's the question.
That's good. I realized I hadn't used the bell, and I thought, he stopped? I'm going to use the bell.
All right. That's fine. Here's the question. Some years ago, I made a decision that instead of a New Year's resolution, I was going to do something for the rest of the world that would make people happy. And so I sent a letter to a bunch of friends and family telling them that they could hit me in the face with a pie anytime and without warning.
Wow.
Just to make them happy. Kind of like the bell, because you don't have really permission to hit somebody in the face with a pie. But it's enjoyable and it's fun. So I figured if I let people do it, it's not going to hurt. It'll make them happy. We can all have a good time. So the question is this. You're going to do this thing. You're going to give permission to someone, one person, to hit you in the face with a pie. And I'm going to say you can pick any person you want, living, dead, real, imaginary. Who would you like to throw this loving pie in your face?
Oh.
First answer. Well, you got
yeah.
one.
Yeah. Hitler.
Hitler. Yeah.
Hit me in the face, man.
Yeah.
And then tell me what the heck is going on in your mind. That's.
Yeah. That's first answer.
Yeah. I think so.
You would want to. So, yeah. Where would this happen? You got any. Now you have a moment. What do you imagine? You and Hitler hanging out. He's going to hit you in the face with the pie. Let's set the scene a little. What do you got?
Sure. So he like the – well, okay. So the first thing he tried to take over was the beer hall, right? So we'd meet in a beer hall
because
he'd feel comfortable in a beer hall.
Okay.
I don't drink, so that would give him reason to hit me in the face because I'm kind of missing the point of meeting in a beer hall.
He's going to do it because he enjoys it, because it's fun. He's going to have permission.
Yeah. And he has permission because people, when they meet me and I'm at a bar, all interactions happen at bars, right? Yeah. I used to live in Vegas. So I learned very quickly that you've got jobs going to bars, but I'm not going to drink. So I learned how to surreptitiously not have or have a cranberry juice that looked like an alcoholic drink. But inevitably, people would find out that I don't drink. And then I was the narc. And then people wanted to hit me in the face with the pie because they felt that I was judging them or I would get one up on them later. I was setting them up to take advantage of them.
Yeah.
So I think in this imaginary scenario, we're at a beer hall. Hitler gets to hit me in the face with a pie, and he really likes the fact that he can hit me in the face with a pie when he realizes that I'm not going to drink this beer, and I want to have a conversation with him about what the heck's going through his head. That's my payment.
Yeah, and you really want to ask him, like, what are you thinking?
Why? Because I, again, believe nobody's evil. Mm-hmm. Evil is just an easy way to get out of a story, right? What's the meat? Why did this guy do that? Why did this guy build it? Is it his own need for success because he was going to be a famous painter, but then the famous painter told him, go away. So he said, all right, I'm gonna get success this other way. And is it whatever that may be?
So on a human level, person to person, like where is he coming from?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's other issues, but yeah, person to person, where is he coming from? Okay.
I think that's the meat of any interaction.
Yeah. Right. Now, you said one thing. When you were in Las Vegas, you realized that you get jobs by going to bars.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that? How do you get a job going to a bar? I've been to a bar. I never got a job.
No. Never been to a networking event in L.A.?
Okay. Well, that kind of thing.
Right.
You have a somewhat quirky sleeping or bedtime ritual. What is it?
So I don't move when I sleep. guess I'm like Dracula, and I just and I've never moved. I just am kind of dead where I lay and lay. Which one is it?
Lay.
Yeah. Dead where I lay. So I guess my quirk is I just lay down and fall asleep.
Does it upset other people, or is this why your wife left you? No. You could say yes to that.
No, it wasn't for my sleeping habits. So
waking habits?
Now that I'm single and completely bacheloring it and I'm just focusing on work, sometimes I sleep in my clothes because I don't – why do I need to take my clothes off? I'm just me, and it's cold, and so the clothes are just an extra layer. So I just sleep where I lie.
Okay. Lay. All right. Awesome. I got one more last thing to do. This is also something I do with all the guests in the show, and it is a little bit of anagramming. I don't know if you anagram, but basically you take the letters of a word or phrase, and you have to use all of them, and you rearrange them to see what other things might be revealed or what other things it might spell. So I just got a couple here.
Okay. I hope they're not long words because I'm terrible at anagrams.
No, I've already done the anagram.
Oh, nice.
No, I plug it into this computer thing, and then it spits out all the things that, like your name. I put your name,
Glenn
Bunzweiler. And to see what would come. So, for example, almost nothing came out that was useful or interesting.
Just like me.
Well, this is like Glenn Dunzweiler. Here's 173 things, but they were all nonsense. The only one that made some sense was this one, and it was that nothing came out. Glenn Dunzweiler anagrams to geez, null, rewind.
Wow, that's my life.
Is it?
Yeah.
Tell me how.
Geez, this – okay. So I got into teaching in academia. I fell into it. I was working in a shop in Las Vegas, and my shop got bought out by another shop. I didn't want to work for that shop. I applied to be a visiting assistant professor for the dance department at UNLV, and I got it. So within in a month, I was working in a shop pushing boxes to now I'm a professor with all these 20-something dancers. And then I continued on in that academic field just because I thought, well, I'm going to roll with what I got.
Sure.
You know, so now I'm teaching and teaching and teaching. And then I got in a motorcycle accident in 2005. And what was supposed to be, I thought, a two-year job at UC Riverside being the resident lighting and sound designer. Well, now my legs were cut out from under me. I broke my leg and my hip. I had to relearn how to walk. My then girlfriend allowed me to stay in her place and rehabilitate. And then my girlfriend became my wife. And then we bought a house together. Bought a house together first. Then we got married in the backyard. And then I had this job with Great Insurance, but I couldn't go anywhere because I had no legs. You know, I had to relearn how to walk. So I started living this life of the American dream. And I kept asking my dad, is this what I'm supposed to do? Because I never saw me settling down with a stable job with insurance. That wasn't a priority for me. And I never saw myself getting married, and I never saw myself buying a house. And he said, well, it works for me. And, you know, that's the American dream. And so I spent 10 years doing that and ended up pretty much just losing everything and not liking teaching. So there's the, geez, null. And
rewind.
Then rewind. Go back to now that I can walk again. It took me, you know, about 4 years or so to kind of rehab fully. Now I'm saying, okay, well, back before I got in that motorcycle accident in 2004, what was I trying to do? And now I'm working on that. So I like that.
All right. Well, see, now this is the game. Glenn Dunzweiler anagrams to G's, no, rewind, and you say yes. That's an accurate assessment of a certain part of your life. I liked it because I didn't get anything from Glenn Dunzweiler except this, which was, you know, I had to just stop and rewind and do something else. So, okay, it worked for me too. Okay, that's good for you. All right, let's – here's another one. But this is it. You know, can we justify or make sense of the thing in any way? Or now, this one, I did anagram Y homeless.
Nice.
Because it's just the letter Y, and it anagrams to this. Let me read that.
Seems holy.
Seems holy.
I like that.
Is that a little too corny, like, oh, the homeless people, and it seems holy, and I mean, yeah, what... too corny to say that these are the blessed people, the homeless. I mean, I don't know.
Right. So homeless people are either shunned or they're charity projects,
yeah.
Right? And I would say that's the stereotype. So yeah. It seems stereotypical, but homeless people are people first. So they're just dudes. They're just ladies. They're just. So, I like it though, because maybe people will want to see why homeless. Like, oh, it seems holy.
It seems holy. All right. Now, one last thing. I anagrammed Musical Robot. Show. Couldn't tell. What are you doing on that show?
I was the producer-director.
Producer-director. And it's a kids' show.
Yeah, it was...
About these two guys who live inside of a giant musical robot.
Yeah. So Musical Robot is a live act up in Northern California. Yep. And they tour around, and we decided we were going to put together a television show, Musical Robot TV, and pitch it. So we produced the first episode, What is Fun?
Right.
And... Yeah, it was I knew those guys from undergrad in Sacramento,
yep.
And we just connected, and I as a producer have a huge background in production. I mean, I've done a lot, varied, so I just fill the holes. I just make things work. And they wanted to write it. They were competent writers.
Yep.
I said I'll produce and direct, and we got that together. So it was a fun project.
Fun show. Yeah. It seemed like people liked it. Well, here are a bunch of things. I'm not sure. This is kind of a fishing expedition, and
sure,
we find out
if
there's some meaning. So, here's a Musical Robot. One of the things it anagrams to is citrus abloom.
Nice. I like it.
I just saw like orange blossoms and
it's
kind of a nice smell.
A bloom is kind of fun for Musical Robot. It's very. What is the word when it fizzes?
Effervescent.
Yes, it's very. Right. The show is very effervescent.
All right, so that kind of captures a scent of that. Here's another thing: caribou's molt. Now, do caribou's molt? Because I mean, molting is mostly for feathered beasts,
right?
Isn't it? Not sure.
Caribous, though, do have horns, right? They have a rack, and that gets covered with felt, which then goes away, or it melts off, you know. So I guess it's a molting process.
Right. Aren't there some aquatic things that also molt? It's like it's losing some fur. What is molting? Maybe I'm just not sure. You're losing.
I'm not up on my molting definition.
All right. But caribou's molt. They might smell like they molt, but now I'm saying molt all this time. You know how when you say a word a bunch of times,
it doesn't exist anymore in your head. It sounds wrong. It
sounds totally wrong. All right. Here, read this one.
Clamorous bit.
I watched a little Musical Robot. There are clamorous bits.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Clamorous
and
in
getting
this case,
in and out of the robot.
Yeah.
Clamorous.
Clamorous. It's just noisy. I looked it up just to make sure I was using it properly. So that is partly accurate. There are some
clamorous
bits.
You have to show me what this program is. I kind of like this anagram program.
Yeah. Now, here's one. I didn't really think this was going to amount to much.
Orca botulism?
Oh, orca.
Orca botulism.
Orca botulism. Do killer whales get botulism?
Botulism is a bacteria, right?
Yeah, it's like airborne food based bad. Do the orcas get botulism from eating bad fish? Is that possible?
Possibly, yeah. I would guess that if the botulinum, whatever it is, can get into an orca, it would. If it were invasive, it found a way.
Yeah. Now I'm saying that I think it's an airborne pathogen, and orcas obviously live underwater.
I know botulism is the most deadly organism, and it's used in Botox. I know that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's where the bow comes from.
Yeah.
So it's most deadly. And here's the orca is the killer whale. There's a tenuous connection.
I like it.
So maybe the orcas are not suffering from botulism. Maybe they're developing new weapons, botulism-based weapons that they could...
Nice. Yeah, killer whales in different ways.
Accelerate their killing.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know what that would have to do with Musical Robot, but... I mean, Musical Robot did destroy the guy's house, so...
It has nothing to do with the Musical Robot.
Okay.
Except these things all came up, and then some of them were interesting. Anyway, read the next one.
Cob Simulator.
Okay, I don't have any idea what that is, but it sounds...
Like a corn cob?
Why would you want to simulate a corn cob?
Hey, this isn't an X-rated show, man.
I went like, this one's dirty. I don't know how exactly, but this one sounds dirty. Let's move on. How about this last one?
Man, boil a scrotum. That's just not. You just wanted me to say that.
I wanted you to say that. I was willing to say Cobb Simulator, but I wanted you to say boil a scrotum.
Yeah, those two go together in some YouTube channel that's way deep in the web.
So here's the thing: Musical Robot anagrams to boil a scrotum. Can we find any connection between those two?
Yeah, absolutely. Scott Namini, one of the guys, Scott Bott, has a very dark sense of humor, and he would love that the anagram. I'll tell him the anagram, boil a scrotum, is in Musical Robot. The guys would love that.
Okay. All right. Well, the website is it's the Internet Anagram Server. That phrase, Internet Anagram Server, anagrams to I Rearrangement Servant.
Oh, nice.
So, it's actually like a – it's actually
an anagram. It did it on purpose.
It's an anagram robot.
Nice.
So you feed in this and then these things all spit out the other side and, boil a scrotum. All right. Well, we're going to – all right. Well, I'll look for a new Musical Robot T-shirts. I think that's a good tagline, boil a scrotum.
Yeah.
Musical Robot, boil it, like in italics underneath, you could say boil a scrotum.
Right.
Like a call to action.
It might not go too well with the parents at the kids' shows.
Oh, it's right. It's a kids' show. Jeez, I forgot. All right. Well, I think we're out of time.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
You squandered an hour.
That's good.
Here with me.
I can talk with the best of them sometimes. Hopefully it was a little funny.
It was funny. I thought so. I'd like to thank my guest and a darn good sport,
Glenn Dunsweiler,
for coming in this week. If you would like to buy the Comedy Death Star coffee mug, attractive, email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv and tell Lucasfilm that you're doing that.
Yeah.
Our theme music, which you'll hear when you listen to the thing in a couple of weeks, theme music was written and performed by Dean Mermel. Great friend of mine. You've been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week or so.
Or so.
Or so.